Welcome to the History Review channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. It's been quite a busy week for me, between trying to see to it that I don't miss Adolf Hitler's birthday, and also with some releases that I had to do at work on Friday. Luckily, they moved it forward to Friday instead of doing it midnight Saturday. So I worked until well after 10 p.m., and I was very tired. So just needed a bit of a rest on Saturday just to let myself catch up from the week. But otherwise, all is good. And I've been reading comments from people on the channel. In total, I have over 5,000 comments from the channel, which I've saved away in my email, and which I want to use and load onto my websites at some point during this year, so that those conversations can also stimulate from that side. And I do have hundreds more comments to approve. So I wrote a few comments, and I was reading a lot of comments, and there's some very interesting stuff happening. I know what it's like to be a pariah. In my entire life, I've never lived in nations that have been anything other than pariahs. Whether it was Rhodesia or South Africa, I know the feeling, and I know how you are received by others because of the Jewish preemptive lying about you. You find that when you meet other people from other countries, the first thing they do is they start getting angry with you. They don't even know you from a bar of soap, but they've been so conditioned to hate you, even though they don't know you at all. And I experienced this firsthand. In the days just before the internet came to South Africa, there was a service called CompuServe, and I went on to CompuServe for some technical support, and then I discovered that there was a little bit of a social side to CompuServe, and I decided to try and tell people about Africa. And the Americans on there, and this was about 1992, and the Americans on there were overwhelmingly full of hate and anger towards white South Africans. But that is how they had been conditioned by their media to see us. Now, large numbers of them have woken up and they know the truth. But back then, all that preemptive lying that had been done by the Jews, the liberals, and the commie had conditioned people to hate us without knowing our situation at all. So I understand what it's like to be hated, and to be hated by people who don't even know you and don't even know the background of your nation and what you people went through. So on this channel, I can appreciate full well how the Germans, the Italians, the Romanians, the Spanish, and all the allies of the Germans, including the Japanese, must feel. So on this channel, I'll do my utmost to give Germans a little bit of the respect that they deserve so much. They have been hated and lied about endlessly. So here on this channel, we're going to make you feel at home. And I was absolutely delighted to see other viewers climbing in and standing up for the Germans. That was flipping awesome. I really like that. So it was nice to see also Deutschland 402, otherwise known as Ray. He also pitched up because of the other video where I mentioned him and had his video in it. It was nice to see everybody in there doing their thing and talking. And I laughed especially at one of the viewers. His name escapes me now, but he was taking on a Jew troll. And this guy was very confident of himself, this viewer. And he said to the Jew troll, I've never lost an argument on YouTube. Anyway, the Jew troll talked his Jew claptrap, and this guy very patiently and very nicely slam dunked this guy with his own counter arguments. And I could see the guy was absolutely confident of himself, and he knew his stuff, and he could do it without even saying one nasty word. And I laughed so much because he ended off his comment by saying, "Now you be a good boy, and you say, 'Happy birthday, Adolf Hitler.'" And I really liked that. I really liked that touch of class there and that firmness. That is so good. These guys know their stuff. And that's exactly how the white nationalist, white right wing should be. Shouldn't be this ducking and diving and running and hiding. Should be just confronting all these liars and taking them on and saying to them, "Listen, dummy, you're talking a lot of nonsense and we're not interested in nonsense. Now shut your mouth and go away. We're not interested in dealing with liars." So one of the Germans was very taken and was very delighted with the Nazi party anthem, and I did it deliberately that way, where I said, "Please stand up now for the Nazi party anthem," because I thought, accord these people some respect. Accord them some respect. They deserve so much more, and so many millions of their fellow countrymen have perished under absolutely hideous conditions. And these people are not a complaining people. Germans are not crybabies. These are not a whining crybaby people at all. These people take real bullets in the chest, and they do so without any moaning and groaning and so forth. They're not like the Jews. They're the complete opposite of the Jews. The Jews run off screeching and howling about how they've been killed and slaughtered. Meanwhile, hardly anything happened to them at all. To quote David Irving, the British historian, he says, "You know, what is a Holocaust survivor? A Holocaust survivor is somebody to whom hardly anything really happened. And wait until you see the definition of the Holocaust. If you know what the actual Jewish definition of the Holocaust is, you'll fall on your back. The actual definition is any territory that was ruled by Germany." I put up some images which you could look at, but I'm going to read it to you and just tell you where the source is, because I did list the source. I went to the Jewish Virtual Library, and let's take a look at some of their definitions of the Holocaust. The first is Simon Wiesenthal's definition of the Holocaust. This is a notorious Jewish liar, and we'll be talking about this Holocaust. And the Simon Wiesenthal was a guy who invented fairy tales like you can't believe. Anyway, let's read his definition of the Holocaust. And it says, "The destruction of some 6 million Jews by the Nazis and their followers in Europe between the years 1933 to 1945. Take note of that, 1933. You will never hear the Allies talk about World War II beginning in 1933, but the Jews talk about it all the time. And you'll see that there's even that newspaper headline where the Jews declared war on Germany in March 1933. World War II began in 1933, and if you listen to the definition of the Jews themselves, you'll see what they say. You'll see it all revolves around one man, Adolf Hitler. So in the Jewish Virtual Library, under Simon Wiesenthal, we see this definition. It says, "The destruction of some 6 million Jews by the Nazis and their followers in Europe between the years 1933 to 1945. Other individuals and groups were persecuted and suffered grievously during this period, but only the Jews were marked for complete and utter annihilation. The term Holocaust, literally meaning a completely burned sacrifice, tends to suggest a sacrificial connotation to what occurred. The word Shoah, originally a biblical term meaning widespread disaster, is the modern Hebrew equivalent. Holocaust, by the way, had a totally different meaning before the Jews decided to put it to this use. Holocaust was about burning sacrifices. Now, if we go to the Jewish Virtual Library and we see their definition, the Jewish Virtual Library's definition of Holocaust reads as follows. The Holocaust refers to the period from January 30th, 1933, when Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, to May 8th, 1945, VE Day, that's victory in Europe, the end of the war in Europe. So the official Jewish definition of Holocaust is from January 30th, 1933, the day Adolf Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany. There was no war on that day. There was no war. War started in 1939, September 1939. But the Jews will tell you that the Holocaust began on the day Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany. So that's interesting. The Jews were at war with Hitler from the day he came to power. And we're not even getting round to the whole issue of how they tried to stop him getting to power. Oh, they tried to trip that man up plenty. And just for fun, I wanted to show you that the Jews don't just lie about the Jews that were killed. The Jews claim that the Germans killed another 5 million Europeans. And in their Jewish Virtual Library, I noticed the way that they word it. It's pretty cunning, real Jew cunning here. It says, how many Jews were murdered during the Holocaust? While it is impossible to ascertain the exact number of Jewish victims, statistics indicate that the total was over 5.86 million. 6 million is the round figure accepted by most authorities. Oh, isn't it a fun one, where they pretend to have some kind of accuracy and then they just always jump forward to that 6 million, okay? They pretend that they counted 5.86 million. And then they're just like, oh yeah, well, you know, it's like we just rounded to 6. And then about the Europeans, they claim that the Germans murdered 5 million, including gypsies, Serbs, Polish intelligentsia, resistance fighters from all nations. It says German opponents of Nazism, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, habitual criminals and the antisocials, beggars, vagrants and hawkers. So they claim all those people were murdered by the Germans. Interesting that they mention the Polish intelligentsia. Poland had the highest portion of Jews in its population of any country in Europe. Funny that they don't mention the 30,000 Polish officers murdered by the Soviets in Katyn Forest. And you don't have to guess the amount because there were actual bodies that you could go and count. And the Germans allowed people to come and count the bodies and study the situation. So unlike the Jewish claims that, no, you can't really establish the number of people killed. Yes, you can. There's a thing called forensic science. And if you allowed scientists to go and start digging up the places where you claimed all the dead Jews are buried, then we'd soon know exactly what it was. And we wouldn't have to listen to Jewish fairy tales of how these people died, if they died at all. Because we'd have forensic science. And we could go and say, ah, we went and dug up these bodies and we found these traces of this and that. And therefore we ascertained so many people of this age died and the period during which they died was that. You could have a whole set of scientific reports, whole bunch of analyses done by dozens of different scientists, and they could come and say to you, you know, we think that Auschwitz was in operation between this date and this date. And if this was real, they could come out and they could say, oh, you know, we found so many bodies here, and they buried so many there, and from these traces we can tell their age, and from the DNA we can tell you that the Jews who were murdered at Auschwitz came from Hungary, and those came from elsewhere and so forth. They could have done all that kind of stuff. You could have written whole encyclopedias on this business if it was real. Instead, we have Jewish, quotes, scholarship with all these gigantic holes in them, as if you can't go and dig up a body. And what's so beautiful about the Holocaust lie is that they tell you, oh, 1 million died here and 2 million died there and so forth. So if they're showing you the geographical area, you can go there and you can go and start using sonar or dig up some parts of it, and you could go and find yourself some evidence. But we'll get back to this Holocaust that never happened. So when a Jew says that there was this Holocaust and he's a Holocaust survivor, as David Irving says, it's a Jew to whom very little happened during World War II. Now, returning to Jews and Germans, I've heard from Germans how the Jews have treated them in recent times. One German friend of mine left Germany because he couldn't take it anymore. He decided he'd rather risk his life in Africa and rather live among blacks than stay in Germany. And he's managed to carve out a pretty decent life for himself, quite a good life. And he lives here because to him, it's too painful to watch what the Germans go through. So quite often he returns to Germany. He visits his family, and then he says to me, there's no hope for them. Everybody's brain dead. He says, Germany isn't Germany anymore. But he told me how earlier in his life he experienced his own forms of cheating, the way that Jews cheated Germans. And he told me that the Jews can get you into court, and the court is going to work against you. There's no real justice for Germans. And I noticed one of the German viewers, she mentioned on my channel that every Jew she'd met had cheated her. And I can believe that. And I would go so far as to say to Lena, because I think that was her name, I'd go so far as to say to her that these Jews will use this 6 million lie, and they will cheat every German they come across every chance they can get. And they'll do this continuously. They will never forgive. Even though it's something that never even happened, they will use this guilt trip against you Germans endlessly. And as you can see, the Germans have had to give so many billions in reparations. The Germans even had to give Israel free submarines. They gave them a bunch of submarines. And it's the Jews are just fleecing the Germans left, right, and center. And of course, this will never come to an end. Never. This will never stop. This is like the anti-white racism that's going on. And affirmative action in South Africa, and affirmative action in America. You'll see all these things will never come to an end. The fleecing of the whites, the cheating of the white people will never stop. The cheating and the murdering and all that, it will never stop until we again manage to gather enough strength to beat off our enemies. But this is the rotten situation in which we find ourselves. And we have no way forward except to try and be constructive about it and positive and logical about it and do what we do best, which is work against it and learn to work against it and build up momentum to fight our way to freedom again for all of us, because we're all in big trouble. And even the English, I was reading some of Hitler's views on the English. I was looking through Hitler's table talk because it contains discussions that he had either at lunchtime or at evening meals. And it was compiled by Martin Bormann. And apparently these discussions were written down and signed off. It's a lot like Napoleon where he said many things that people then immediately wrote down and kept. So when Napoleon spoke, many people remembered what he said, and they wrote it down, and you can find lots of the sayings and the thoughts of Napoleon. And Napoleon's ones are very concise and brilliant, and we will also go and study some of them. Because Napoleon had a very radical mind, a very radical mind. He was as radical as Hitler. He had a different focus, but he was radical like Hitler, and the two of them are similar in certain ways. There are certain common European lessons of history that they've learned. By the way, I was very fascinated by Nordlux's comments about his investigation into the Thracians, because they are among the oldest, if not the oldest, Europeans. And I will be contacting him this week. So he's got special insight into real ancient European history. And in this regard, I should mention something else that I've never mentioned before. Did you know that the oldest building in the world, the oldest building in the world, can be found in, guess where? Ireland. Now, doesn't that strike you as strange? And I think this building is 8,000 years old, and its entrances line up exactly with the rising and setting of the sun at the equinoxes. But I thought I'd just mention that very quickly. And remember, in ancient times, when there was an ice age, you could walk from Europe through the British Isles all the way to Ireland. So Ireland and Scotland and Britain as we know it was joined to Europe. But you won't hear much said about this building in Ireland, as old as it is. Anyway, let's return to Adolf Hitler's table talk. So while I was browsing through Adolf Hitler's table talk, I stumbled on some interesting discussions that he had. And it made me think of some of the ideas I was trying to put forward in some of my more recent videos. You'll remember I did a video about turning liberal America and Europe into Jewish Russia, where I was saying that the whole game is to change the demographic makeup so that the Jews can get advantages in the future and that they'll be able to use this multi-cult so that they can destroy our elite and defeat them like they did in Russia, while of course enslaving everybody in the process. And in that video and other videos, I've mentioned some of my more recent thoughts where the more I look at liberalism, the more it seems like just a scam. It's just a scam. It's just a mind game. It's not even anything real. It's not even based on anything that is actually factual. It is a deliberate inversion of history and of science in every conceivable way so that it benefits the Jews. Plus, it's also a con game, a long con, and the Jews know that the time may come where people will wake up and realize it's a con, and the Jews have to have all their mechanisms in place to suppress people, and also in the event that they can't suppress people totally and keep everyone down, that they also have to be able to make a run for it, and all that sort of thing. So what I was alluding to was the notion that Jews, as a group, will lie in unison, and they will lie in support of each other. And the extent to which they will go to lie and to mislead huge groups of people is absolutely beyond belief. Adolf Hitler mentioned this in Mein Kampf, and I've brought this up before, where he's mentioned that the Jew, with their unbelievable capacity for lying, that the Jew will tell the biggest, boldest lies imaginable and blast them out. The Jew has no interest whatsoever in the truth or reality. The Jew will tell any lie as long as it benefits him or his group. And in my video about the Jewish strategy of lying, Jews 102, I went through a whole thing about whites versus Jews. It's about the truth versus the lie. But like with this Holocaust thing, the Jews will just make up stories, man, and they'll just make them up and embellish them, and they'll just go crazy with this stuff. And of course, the Jews take everything and invert it. So left becomes right, up becomes down, progress becomes bad, going backwards is good. This Jewish technique of lying is very present in communism and communism's offshoots, because the Jews were also heavily involved in that. So you'll hear these misleading terms used by these leftists and Stalinists and Leninists and all that, where they use the term progressive. Here in South Africa and in Africa, the blacks were always talking about being progressive, but actually it's being regressive. They are not bringing new facts. They are actually undoing civilization. They are fighting against civilization. In the early days of African crisis, one of my readers posted some comments, and he was talking about the African National Congress, who now rules South Africa. And he spoke about their struggle. And he said that what they are doing is they want to liberate themselves from civilization. They're in a war against civilization, actually. And that is what communism boils down to. All this leftism, this is not progress. This is actually undoing civilization. It's a war against civilization. It's not a war for knowledge. It's a war for stupidity. And that is what has been going on for decades in so many forms, where they bring in stupidity and they make people forget the things that were real, and they bring across this veil of stupidity, and slowly people begin to forget real history, real facts, real lessons of life. That's why when you mention the names Napoleon and Hitler, you get all these people spitting at it, saying, oh, this is terrible, this is disgusting. And then, of course, the preconditioned answer that everybody's got to buy into is that only democracy is good. Everything else is bad. Only democracy can bring results. But, of course, for the rich and the Jews, democracy is the easiest thing to corrupt, the easiest thing to control. It's like that snide observation that some American made, to the effect that if voting resulted in real change, or there was any real power at stake here, then they would, of course, not allow anybody to do it. And in effect, there's a lot of truth in this, tremendous truth in this. As Alex Linder says, elections in America are a Jewish funhouse. Every party's been bought, and those who can't be bought are destroyed. But returning to this notion of Jews operating as a team, lying in unison and misleading large numbers of people in unison as a team, this is very interesting. And it was while I was browsing Hitler's table talk that I came across two references where Hitler explained this in detail. And remember now, Hitler's table talk is from when he was in power. So he was now the Führer. And he'd had additional experiences since he'd written Mein Kampf, because he was only about 34 years old when he wrote Mein Kampf. So it was while I was reading through this and looking at some of these things that Hitler was saying to other people at dinner conversations that I thought I'd draw your attention to this. Because here he talks in a more specific term, and he gives us more insight into the Jews operating as Team Jew, Team Lying Jew, misleading people. And incidentally, this is about art. So Hitler's pet subject is art, because of his earlier interests in art and architecture. And he mentions how the Jews tricked the rich. And I looked at this and I thought it was a very interesting thing to point out. He discusses the scams of how the Jews scammed the rich with art. Now, what he says about art could, of course, apply to anything. It could apply to any kind of market. It could apply to the stock market, to property markets. You know, there's that quote from, I think it was a Rothschild, who said something like, "You must buy when the blood is running in the streets." Now, this is the kind of thinking that you drive certain prices down of the things you really want so that you can catch them later at rock bottom prices and so forth. But I wanted to read to you some of Hitler's comments about the Jews and art and what the Jews did with art. Because if the Jews did it with art, they can do it to businesses, they can do it, like I say, to stock markets, maybe even to whole countries. Now, there's a lot of stuff that we just accept about the Jews because we don't dig enough. Take, for example, the notion of Jews being the cleverest people on the planet. And then, of course, the Jews hold up Einstein and they say, "Oh, you know, this is the greatest scientist of all time, and he was a Jew." Now, for example, when it comes to money and finances, they say, "Oh, the Jews are so good with money." But when I watched some of my Jewish friends, I saw a lot of them were a bunch of skinflints, I might add. And yes, their every thought is preoccupied with money. But I ask myself, how much of Jewish success is due to them being genuinely good at something? Or how much is due to them playing as Team Jew, to quote Alex Linder? In the past, I had a lot of interest in stock markets. And it's something that I've played with on and off during my life, and mostly with failure rather than success. But I would read up and I'd dig and I'd eventually put my money where my mouth is. And normally it would go quite well in the beginning. And then as I got more into it, then suddenly I'd find myself losing quite a bit of money. But I used to start asking myself questions about many of these things and how they really work. And there was a time several years ago where I spent a lot of time doing some statistical analysis of stock market prices. I kid you not, I had a computer at home and it was running statistical analyses for me day and night for a year. I dug into every conceivable thing I could think of. Now, I'm not an advanced mathematician, but there were some things that began to bother me. And I began to ask myself some questions about it. And even stock markets, you know, the fact that stock markets have these cycles. I ask myself, how much of this is natural? How much of it is really something that would happen in a non-Jew dominated world? Would stock market crashes be as regular and as nasty as they are and as they have been in recent centuries? And I was going to touch a little bit on the stock market. I'm just going to skimp over it quickly just to get you thinking some thoughts. And you'll remember from the Great Jewish Mask that we discovered how the Jews had stolen all their ideas from the Babylonians, including the notion of being a moon people. Now, in one of my weirder books from my wonky days, I have all these books that have got scientific anomalies in them, etc. I collected these things. I spent a bunch of money on these sorts of things, and I was fascinated by them. And in there, I found a study done by some scientists at some point where they noticed a strange pattern in the stock market that matched the moon cycles. Now, how crazy is that? Why would there be anything in the stock markets that would match up with the movements of the moon and the phases of the moon? So people might say, but that's proof of astrology. And indeed, that's the kind of conclusion I would have jumped to earlier in my life. But nowadays, I sit and I ask myself, could it be that there is some kind of hidden, let's call it moon phase stuff in some of the stock markets? But is it really due to the moon? Or is it due to the Jews playing a game and using their, quotes, moon religion as signals for them acting in unison? So think about that. Could those moon-type things be an indication that there is some kind of Jewish manipulation going on? But this particular study wasn't particularly firm and all that, and I'm not going to go into all the details, but I just want to mention it as an idea. I think it's something that maybe somebody should look at a little bit more closely. Is it possible that Jews, using their religion as a code, has them doing certain things in unison at certain times? In other words, like, take for example also the annual stock market slump on the world's markets. If you watch the stock markets annually, the worst month for the stock market is September. And strangely, it's September that also appears in many other world events. My Boer Nazi pal used to say to me, it's shocking how many things have happened in September. But when you are dealing with the moon phases, and take for example something like Easter, where those holidays are determined also by the moon, how the dates shift backwards and forwards over a period of time because the moon phases and the solar cycle don't match exactly. Then go and look at some of these stock market crashes and things. Things that happen in September. And you'll often see the market slumping in September, but then it'll move slightly into October or slightly into August. And you might say, well, maybe that is just the natural way things are, that due to the way of the economy, it's like that. But I thought I'd just mention some of these things, some of these funny correlations, and say, can you detect any moon-related patterns in anything financial? That really is my question. Can you detect moon-related patterns in anything financial? And if so, can that then lead you to some Jews who are busy playing a game, using the moon as their common denominator, so they don't have to tell each other exactly when they're going to do it? They know that it must be done within a certain period of time and so forth. I'm very curious about the secret things the Jews might be doing. Secret coordination of Jews in financial things. Is there such a thing? Has anyone ever dug deeper into it? And is it something that can be linked to their religion and that moon stuff of theirs? So those are just some thoughts I want to just put out there, just to throw them out. It may be that it's a nutty idea, but I thought I'd just throw it out there and make you think a little bit more about Jewish financial conspiracies. So let's take a closer look at Adolf Hitler and what he uncovered about Jewish financial conspiracies in the world of art. So what I'm about to read are some excerpts from a very long conversation and discussion that he had On 27th March 1942 at midday. It's a very long thing, very interesting stuff, including some remarks on women in politics. Very interesting. We must come back to some of these things. But on page 157, I'm going to start reading certain portions to you. And it goes like this. Here it goes. Hitler says, "It's striking to observe that in 1910, our artistic level was still extraordinarily high. Since that time, alas, our decadence has merely become accentuated. In the field of painting, for example, it's enough to recall the lamentable daubs that people have tried to foist in the name of art on the German people." Now, when you hear the Weimar Republic, that was when they sort of didn't even call Germany Germany. This was after World War I. And it was during that time when the Jews were trying to crush everything that had German spirit in it and anything like that. And they were trying to turn the Germans into communists and liberals. So Hitler says the following. "This was quite especially the case during the Weimar Republic, and that clearly demonstrated the disastrous influence of the Jews in matters of art. The cream of the jest was the incredible impudence with which the Jews set about it." Now listen to this. "With the help of phony art critics, and with one Jew bidding against another, they finally suggested to the people, which naturally believes everything that's printed, a conception of art according to which the worst rubbish in painting became the expression of the height of artistic accomplishment. The 10,000 of the elite themselves, despite their pretensions on the intellectual level, let themselves be diddled and swallowed all the humbug. The culminating hoax, and we now have proof of it, thanks to the seizure of Jewish property, is that with the money they fraudulently acquired by selling trash, the Jews were able to buy at wretched prices the works of value they had so cleverly depreciated. Every time an inventory catches my eye of a requisition carried out on an important Jew, I see that genuine artistic treasures are listed there. It's a blessing of providence that National Socialism, by seizing power in 1933, was able to put an end to this imposture." So there you can see that Hitler was catching out these Jews. These Jews had built up big art collections of really valuable paintings, but they acquired their money by first selling rubbish and promoting rubbish as a new form of art. And I suspect that a lot of it has to do with what's called, quotes, modern art. But Hitler goes on. He says, "When I visit an exhibition, I never fail to have all the daubs pitilessly withdrawn from it. It will be admitted that whoever visits the house of German art today will not find any work there that isn't worthy of its place. Everything that hasn't an undeniable value has been sieved out. I never hesitated, even when it was a question of works by painters given prizes by the Academy of Prussia, to ban these works from the house of German art whenever they were worthless. It's a pity that the Academy is not up to its task and that its members played amongst themselves the game of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours." Now let me read some more. And here Hitler gets funny. I like his hard-hitting analyses. Listen to this. He says, "The latest victim was our Minister of Religious Affairs, who knows as much about art as a hippopotamus. He fell into the most obvious traps and gave official rewards to genuine hors d'oeuvre. The Jews had succeeded in lulling him to sleep by using on him the same methods as had already enabled them to trick the whole German people. On the subject of these daubs, people assert that it isn't easy to understand them, and that to penetrate their depth and significance, one must be able to immerse oneself entirely in the image represented, and other idiocies from the same mill. In the years 1905 to 1906, when I entered the Vienna Academy, these hollow phrases were already being used to give publicity to innumerable daubs under the pretext of artistic experiment. In a general way, the academies have nothing to tell me that's worth listening to. In fact, the professors who are active there are either failures or else artists of talent, but who cannot devote more than 2 hours a day to their teaching, or else weary old men who therefore have nothing more to give. Genuine artists develop only by contact with other artists. Like the old masters, they began by working in a studio. Let's remember that men like Rembrandt, Rubens, and others hired assistants to help them to complete all their commissions. Amongst these assistants, only those reached the rank of apprentice who displayed the necessary gifts as regards technique and adroitness, and of whom it could be supposed that they would in their turn be capable of producing works of value. It's ridiculous to claim, as it's claimed in the academies, that right from the start, the artist of genius can do what he likes. Such a man must begin, like everyone else, by learning, and it's only by working without relaxation that he succeeds in achieving what he wants. If he doesn't know the art of mixing colors to perfection, if he cannot set a background, if anatomy still has secrets for him, it's certain he won't go very far. I can imagine the number of sketches it took an artist as gifted as Menzel before he set himself to paint the flute concert at Sansuki. It would be good if artists today, like those of olden days, had the training afforded by the masters' studios and could thus steep themselves in the great pictorial traditions. If, when we look at the pictures of Rembrandt and Rubens, for example, it is often difficult to make out what the master has painted himself and what his pupils share. That's due to the fact that gradually the disciples themselves became masters. What a disaster it was, the day when the state began to interfere with the training of painters. As far as Germany is concerned, I believe that two academies would suffice, in Düsseldorf and Munich, or perhaps three in all, if we add Vienna to the list. Obviously, there's no question for the moment of abolishing any of our academies, but that doesn't prevent one from regretting that the tradition of the studios has been lost. If, after the war, I can realize my great building program, and I intend to devote thousands of millions to it, only genuine artists will be called on to collaborate. The others may wait until doomsday, even if they're equipped with the most brilliant recommendations. So there you also got some idea of Hitler's views of art, and that it has to be practiced properly, and that you need real skill, and that no amount of nonsense talk gets away from the fact that it's an actual skill that you need to learn and practice properly. And he didn't want all this half measures and rubbish. But the interesting part in that were the scams of the Jews. Now, let's go and look at some more. So I'm doing this a little bit backwards, because what I read to you there was from early 1942. Now I'm going to read a little piece for you from the night of the 23rd to 24th December 1941. So it seems they were chatting past midnight. And he talks about a couple of things here. So Hitler says, It occurs to me that already Lynn's museum can bear comparison with no matter which museum in New York. In the years 1890 to 1900, one could still form great collections. After that, it became practically impossible to lay one's hand on the truly great works. The Jews mounted guard and monopolized the lot. If I'd had money sooner, I'd have been able to keep in Germany a number of works that have emigrated. Just take note here that Hitler's talking about the Jews monopolizing art. Monopolizing art. Here in South Africa, where the English and the Jews, and Jews from Germany, by the way, as well, came and fiddled around and played with diamonds and gold, South Africa is a land of monopolies and oligopolies. I doubt that there's another country on earth with as many monopolies and oligopolies as South Africa. And the laws of South Africa are devised just for the super rich. It's a topic I want to tackle sometime later, but it's interesting to hear Hitler talk about Jews creating monopolies because South Africa is such a country. You won't believe the extent to which all kinds of free economic activity is completely illegal in South Africa. They've tied this country up in every which way that you can imagine. No white, no black, nobody can do certain things. There are lots of things that are just blocked and barred. And these are laws that were created long time ago when all these super rich were busy here in South Africa. Oh boy, the South African Parliament must have been a place that was just passing laws for the Jews and the super rich. Because in South Africa, you won't believe the kinds of laws that exist. So let's see what Adolf Hitler says here. He says, if I'd had money sooner, I'd have been able to keep in Germany a number of works that have emigrated. It's lucky I got there finally. Otherwise, we'd have nothing left but rubbish. For the Jews do their business in works of real value. They made use of literature to achieve this. What we should blame is, firstly, the cowardice of our bourgeoisie, and, next, the state of society, and in brackets, for which the bourgeoisie is equally responsible, close brackets, whereby only a tiny fraction of the population is interested in art. The Jew was able to say to himself, these Germans who accept perverse pictures of the crucified Christ are capable of swallowing other horrors too, if one can persuade them that these horrors are beautiful. The people were not concerned in such matters. It was all the affair of the so-called elite, who believed in their own competence, whereas in reality they were not capable of telling the difference between what was beautiful and what was ugly. This setup was useful to me at the period when, although I still hadn't much money, I began to buy. This is very interesting that Adolf Hitler seemed to be investing in art, and I can't quite make out how much of it was due to him doing this in private, and how much of it was due to him being in politics or being the Führer. I assume some of this is in private. It seems to be like that. So here we have Hitler the art collector discerning value and deciding what to buy, and he can see the Jews are busy playing a game here. And because of his own knowledge, he is able to benefit from it. So Hitler continues, another thing that was useful to me in England was the fact that certain works, by reason of their subjects, did not fit in with the conformist morals of society. So it was that I was able to take possession of the admirable Venus by Bourdon, which formerly belonged to the Duke of Kent. I'm delighted that I succeeded in obtaining in England some works of the highest level in exchange for some horrors boosted by the Jewish critics. These are real forgers' tactics on the Jews' part, for they're perfectly well aware of the worthlessness of the works they're boosting. They've used this transvaluation of values to buy surreptitiously and at favorable price the masterpieces they had depreciated. So again we see Hitler talking about the Jews using forgers' tactics. The Jews go and push down the value of something, something that is really valuable, but they push down the prices way down low because they're going to snap it up later when nobody's looking. And I must say, that makes me think of the gold price. The gold price was driven down for decades, driven down. Every central bank was selling gold. So this is very interesting where he says they've used this transvaluation of prices to buy surreptitiously and at favorable prices. So what Hitler's really telling you in these discussions is how the Jews have manipulated the world's art market and how they obtained things of real value and how they also sold rubbish in order to get money, and they drove down the value of the items that had real value so that they could later snap them up. Now you must ask yourself, on what scale are the Jews playing these games? Maybe they're doing this to the tune of billions and even trillions of dollars. How do we know that these same Jewish tactics are not being used in all kinds of other markets? And of course, we have to ask ourselves, is there any way we can use any of this by whites as a way of regaining control of the things we've lost? And again, it makes me also look at the Jews just as mere criminals acting in teams. And the team lies in unison, works together in unison, and they set out to deceive people in unison. They go and they set out to deceive even the intellectuals, even the rich. They go and they cheat them, and they do it in such a cunning manner. But my question is, if the Jews were doing this in art, and Adolf Hitler was able to perceive this and watch this, how do you know the Jews are not doing this in stock markets and all kinds of other markets, property markets, all sorts of things? How do you know that the Jews aren't able to drive down certain companies in order to snap them up again? What other financial games are the Jews playing in this world? And maybe these games are so big that we regard them as some kind of natural normal cycle, and maybe they aren't a natural normal cycle at all. So that is what I'd like to leave you with. Some thoughts from Adolf Hitler, because art was his thing. And here he tells you how he was able to buy up artworks and invest in artworks, and how he saw the Jews and their tactics. And notice the use of phony art critics, phony intellectualism. And of course you see the same thing happening today. Jews using all these professors, and a professor talks his rubbish about liberalism. And there must be a lot of weak-minded people, sitting in a university somewhere who are willing to sell their integrity and to go and push something because the Jews are going to give him a lot of good publicity. He would otherwise have remained an unknown and nobody would have cared about him. But now the Jew gives him some publicity, makes him look like he's an intellectual. Meanwhile, he's a fraud and he's just willing to say any old rubbish. And the Jew, of course, is the one who's going to be profiting. The Jews will no doubt be giving them a few scraps from the billions that the Jews are making. But you need to ask yourself, how much of this kind of tactic is carrying on in the modern world? And here we are believing that there are these laws of economics and stuff. Meanwhile, National Socialism was approaching this thing from a completely different angle. And we'll go and look more closely at National Socialism. There are ideas and concepts that when I was younger, I used to listen to these and they sounded great. I really believed that if the world was run by the moneyed people, that they'd make a lot better decisions than the politicians. But I must tell you, I'm starting to think that the world needs kings again and emperors and stuff like that. Because when you see what people get up to as groups, it's freaking scary, man. And there are some things that, in the same way that Hitler was into art, because that was his first love when he was younger, he was into art and architecture. Now, in my own line of work, which is software, I've also watched all kinds of scams going on. I've watched how people have made tens of millions out of all kinds of junk. And there are some of these things that I've looked back at and I've thought to myself, maybe there are some things where business and the way business is conducted in the modern world is so unbelievably unethical that you really need to go and get government control and do something like the Nazis did. There was, for example, certain unethical stock market practices that the Nazis killed off. They sorted this kind of stuff out. They didn't let people just mess around with the markets. And from my own experience in my own career, I can tell you that you can make a case to prove that there are times when big businesses stop progress. They actually stop progress, and they deliberately will sell inferior products because they can make more money out of that. The notion that business people equate to progress is not true. There are those like the Henry Fords and the Teslas who had certain visions. And the guys like the Teslas would put knowledge and public benefit ahead of his own personal well-being. If Nikola Tesla had wanted to, he could have probably been the world's first trillionaire. This guy invented such incredible things that drive almost everything we have to this day. One of those things was alternating current. But people like Nikola Tesla, who put the benefits to civilization of his own talents first, a guy like that is rare, and there are lots and lots of wealthy people who rather operate the other way round. And they even do things to slow down progress, to destroy things that could be competition. Leon de Grel, in one of his books about Hitler, I need to go and look a bit more closely at that, but he spoke about all kinds of really unethical things that Hitler stopped in Germany with these financial markets. And Hitler did not tolerate that businesses should also be treasonous. If you were rich, you could make your money in Germany. Adolf Hitler wouldn't hassle you. But if you thought that you now had a license to operate against Germany, against the German people, against the German government, then Adolf Hitler sorted your ass out. And these days, these rich and super rich and these Jews, they engage in every conceivable kind of treason and they break every conceivable rule. And it's all done on the notion that everything business does is good and that business in its mysterious way, which only the Jews understand, is beneficial to all mankind. I think that we are dealing with scams of such an enormous nature that we would fall on our backs if we knew what was going on. But these observations of Adolf Hitler certainly make me think. When I was younger, I was never against the idea that a man should be rich. If a man or a woman worked hard and they came up with great ideas, I believed in the American dream, in that kind of principle. If somebody comes and he does great good, let him benefit from it. I'm happy that a guy like Henry Ford became a billionaire, that he became the world's first billionaire. He deserved it. But he was an honorable man. He was completely different to these other kinds. But I've got to admit that some of the things that these rich get up to are absolutely disgusting. And the other thing is when the rich back fake revolutions. There are real revolutions that really matter to the common people, that have principles that mean something to the common people. And then these people come and they play around with it. And they use the common people as cannon fodder for a fake revolution, which puts them back at square one, even worse than they were before. So those are some observations from Adolf Hitler. And maybe it's some food for thought. That's really what I was trying to get at here, was some food for thought, for people to sit and think about some of his observations that he had, because all that kind of grand theft at a high level is probably extremely active to this day, and perhaps on a scale that would just make us throw up if we knew how bad it really was. So that's it for today. We'll be chatting again soon. We've got lots of stuff to catch up on and lots of other topics to look at. Take care.